What's going down, wonderful humans? It's been a while. I do apologize. This is episode 49 of the Brian Kenny podcast. So, I've been on a little bit of a hiatus. I apologize. There's been a lot kind of moving, a lot going on. That is absolutely no excuse for not putting out more podcasts. And I promise I'm going to step up my game. I'm going to step up to the plate. I'm going to start creating more podcasts. Getting back to the regular scheduled one episode per week. I'm not going to say anything else about it. It is happening. I'm on it, I promise. Thank you for still tuning in. Okay, so in this episode, I get to interview the wonderful Mr. Sean Judge. I don't think he really needs a lot of introduction because I think in the Dublin tech scene, Sean is a really well-known person. He is currently the entrepreneur in residence at Accenture. And I would say the best way to describe what that position is that he helps to facilitate the connection between the young startups or the startups around Dublin and even further outside of Dublin and Accenture as a business itself. Also, he is the director of Upstarter. Upstarter has been around for a good few years now, and I would say it is the primary or the main event in Dublin that is a technology-focused recruitment event. So has lots of really great companies all within one room. Lots of really great people come into that room. Great conversations happen. Great connections start to get made. That's Upstarter. So if you haven't already, go and check Upstarter. Go and check out upstarter.ie and you'll get all of the details there. And I guess as well, something to note is that myself and Sean worked on a startup together. In Minicorp, we helped to build an application or product called UniTuition. And UniTuition was an online platform for connecting students with tutors. So helping them to, you know, get grinds, get courses, get information from tutors on multiple different subjects and how we could facilitate that connection between the student needing the tutor and the tutor needing some work or some extracurricular work in order to get them through the whole college thing. So it's a really, really interesting and exciting episode. And yeah, I think you're all going to love it. So without further ado, I'm not going to sit here and ramble on. There is plenty more episodes for that. And I hope you really enjoy it. And let's get into the show. I am here with the awesome, the wonderful Mr. Sean Judge, and I always start off these podcasts by letting the guests introduce themselves, by mainly because of fear that I'm just going to butcher it myself, so go for it.
Hey everyone, cheers for having me, Brian.
No worries.
So yeah, I'm Sean Judge, I suppose former co-founder of UniTuition. Current director of Upstarter, a tech recruitment event, and entrepreneur in residence in Accenture.
Awesome. And thank you very much for coming on. So I always start at the very beginning of each of the people that I interview. So where did you grow up and where did it all start?
Yeah, so originally from Santry in Dublin.
Nice.
Currently now being a trader, not living on the north side, to the bane of my parents.
Do you get abused by all of your friends and everything from Santry?
Yeah, all the Santry friends or my family who have all stayed on the north side, I get that get abused a lot. Yeah.
You traitor. Yeah. And when you were growing up, were you surrounded at any point by computers and tech? Was there anything within your family that they that pushed you towards the digital side of it?
Yeah, no, not really. Yeah, probably wouldn't have been the most academic in school whatsoever. Would not have been a computer nerd in any way. Still amn't really, as in, I wouldn't be a gamer. Wouldn't be techie in any sort of context. I went to college, did a business degree. Always wanted to be a stockbroker. Eventually became a stockbroker.
And then, wow.
Yeah, left that pretty quickly after I realized that the early mornings weren't for me.
So hold up. So. When you're growing up, was there So I remember very clearly for me as a child when I was growing up that when I went to school and things, it was really to hang out with my friends. I was absolutely not there in any academic capacity at all. It was, you know, playing basketball, hanging out with mates was one of the biggest reasons that I went to school or look forward to going to school. Would it have been similar to you that you didn't really kind of find a great association with the different subjects early on?
Yeah, like I was in no way academic until probably about fifth year when I realized that I probably had to get a good Leaving Cert to go to college.
Leaving Cert is coming.
Get a job that I actually wanted to do. Like we had a family business that I worked in, kind of in a print business for all the summers throughout, like from like second year in school. So I realized probably around fifth year that I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life, so basically had to cop on a bit in school and actually study. But yeah, school itself was probably more sports. Like I was big into athletics.
And did you feel like a lot of pressure to say, okay, I need to get a college degree if I want to go for like a job, a high paying job or something?
Yeah, I think that was definitely the route that we were encouraged to take on. And you really, like, I suppose now if you have coding skills, you can be self-taught and you don't need to go to college to learn that. And I suppose a lot of the stuff that I learned in college would have been more about like how to interact with people in a professional sense and that kind of way, more so than the actual stuff that I learned, the content wise. I don't think I use any of that anymore in my work life now. Or so even when I was in graduate jobs, I don't think much of the stuff that I learned in college was directly applicable.
That's crazy. But when you, so that's a very big point, isn't it? Like when you think about it, if you were to have a conversation with your younger self now and, you know the ambition and everything that you have, would you have still said that, you know, college is a prerequisite to getting to where I want to go, or it's the path I should take?
I think the path I went through and I suppose applying to graduate jobs and getting a kind of a qualification in stockbroking, I definitely wouldn't have got into that route, which has led me to where I am now, if I hadn't have gone to college.
Sure.
But I do think, probably companies look at college education as more of a filtering process rather than a, like what you're going to learn here is going to be used directly on the job. I suppose when so many people are applying for jobs, I think it's more so now, a filtering tool.
It's strange. Like when I look to hire somebody in MiniCorp, it's a completely different hiring process versus the hiring process that I would have grown up with. So I would have absolutely had the same kind of mental imagery of how the whole career system would have worked. I always wanted to get a job in computer science in any shape or form, be it in hardware or software. And I kind of always wondered, did I need that college degree in order to get to, you know, a couple of steps up the ladder? And now when we look to hire people, it's a completely different kettle of fish. It's who you're introduced to and what have they built before with their own hands, and, you know, how have they gotten past that last 10% where you're wondering, you know, is this good enough to put out there in the world now, or should I hold back and polish it a bit more? And all of these other problems that you kind of get through experience more than kind of just dipping your toe in the water and beginning. And I guess that's the difference as well between like a graduate job and a, you know, year two, year three in your first time job type of thing.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. So you went and you studied business in...
Yeah, business economics in Trinity. That was my first 4 years, and went in to work for a company called NCB that got bought over by Investec then.
Wow.
And stayed there for about a year, did my like stockbroking and trading exams, and then realized that it really wasn't where I wanted to be. 6:30 a.m. starts in the morning. It was like long days.
Man, that's amazing. That was like, if I had to pick between a couple, like three different careers, career number one, obviously in computers and products. Number two would have been in stockbroking as well, or some connotation of it. And number three would have been in architecture, I think. So how did you know, or what was it about the whole stockbroking industry that attracted you to it?
Yeah, my family and my grandparents actually were kind of in that industry, not as a profession, but more as a kind of a hobby. They were very interested in just like following stocks. So it was always around my house that we follow things like that, which I suppose was quite unusual.
Amazing though.
Yeah, and then I think when I was like going through your career options of what I was good at and what I had an interest in, I was like kind of always on the finance side of things, which is actually just a stark contrast now to what I am, I suppose, interested in. Then just ended up kind of applying to tons of jobs. So it was 2011, I think I was finishing college, like in the middle of the recession. Everyone was cutting their banking jobs or their stockbroking jobs. So I think I applied to like 30 different grad programs and maybe got two or three of them. But like the one that I ended up taking was front office stockbroking. Like you would actually be trading yourself on I didn't get to that point because I left so soon, but that was the route I thought I wanted to go down.
It's insane. I mean, I'm always intrigued by that whole industry, especially like watching movies like Wolf of Wall Street and all the other ones where it's, you know, you get in at the very bottom and then you watch as they kind of turn things around and so on. It's a crazy industry, but I think it does require some really crazy hours and a lot of analytics and understanding and pattern analysis and stuff like that.
Yeah, I just looked at people who were 20 years ahead of me, and they were still doing the insane 12-hour, 14-hour days that I just didn't see myself doing. So not in a lazy context, but more in a, I don't think this is what I want my entire life to be like, as in working. And
that's really cool. So you see a lot of strength in kind of the work-life balance, or not necessarily work-life balance, but that, you know, the head down, just kind of getting through work is not the be-all and end-all. It's about the product of what that kind of creates for you in your life.
Yeah, working smart rather than working, I suppose, to a set timeline. And stockbroking was very like that. You had to be in at 6:30. Yeah. Now I work a very flexible day. Like a lot of time I'm out of the office before 5:30. But again, I'm on emails until late at night. And I'm happy to work that way, that if there's something urgent to get to, I can drop stuff in the evening. But again, I don't like having to be in the office until 6 o'clock, 6:30 every day.
Do you do any meditation or anything?
No, not big into that at all.
The first screen on your phone, is it full of apps, or is there a couple of rows missing?
It is full of apps, but it's I don't group them into folders, so I probably only have about 30 apps on my phone in total, including all the ones that everyone would have. They're not grouped into folders. They're the ones I use constantly.
The reason that I ask these questions is whenever I meet somebody like yourself that obviously values their time very much, and, you know, again, when we hire people in Minicorp, it's not necessarily about working 9 till 5. I have no idea when somebody's going to be the most creative. They could be the most creative at 3 o'clock in the morning or at 11 o'clock in the morning, but it's also up to them to kind of to discover that and to figure it out. And that kind of level of self-awareness allows them to become a better designer or a better engineer, because they're kind of discovering what they love and what they don't like, and they can hone in on what that is for them. But a big part of that for me, and as I kind of get older myself and learn more about myself, it's about holding back on the information that's coming in or being directed at me all the time. I like being connected to my emails. I think that I get connected a little bit too much. And so I've started to do this exercise now where the really critical apps on my home screen will stay there, but I try to pare them back as much as I can. So apps that I'll use on a daily basis stay in the home screen. Anything else can go onto page 2 or page 3 until they eventually get deleted. Mm-hmm. But I find that kind of paring back of the information that's coming at me allows me to be more selective in what I want to accomplish each day. Mm-hmm. You know, that I'm kind of setting up my to-do list and things aren't getting in the way of it, and I'm not getting, you know, inundated with just busy work, as you say.
Yeah.
Which is really handy. So kind of went a bit off in a tangerine there, but so when you were in college, you took part in the 100 Minds scheme?
I actually took part of that after college. I wasn't a student on 100 Minds. I was a mentor, actually after college.
And how did you find that?
Yeah, working was really good. Yeah, DEC was great. It was the year I got involved in it was where they were like getting 1,000 students, so they was gonna try raise the million. So yeah, it was just a massive program to be involved in, and it was at a time where I was looking to do some extra stuff, and I thought, yeah, it was a great initiative to be a part of, and a really great group of people. Actually, a lot of the people who have done that 100 Minds program or who was a mentor on it, I kind of follow what they're currently doing now, and I know the DEC is over in the States, and then there's a startup Box as well. Yeah, I was following what they were doing recently. It's just crazy. A lot of people who are involved in it.
Yeah, so when we look back, just for everyone else listening, and what 100 Minds is, it's an initiative where college students participate within this program, and mentors are assigned to different groups of participants. And they're set with the task of, in some entrepreneurial spirit, to go and to raise money for the selected charity of that year. And the year that Sean was involved in it, they were trying to raise €1 million, which is just insane. Yeah. I think it's been running now for like 5 or 6 years or something like that. But one of the reasons that I love it, so first of all, they're a client within MiniCorp, but second of all, it's that entrepreneurial kind of spirit. When you talked about during your college days of, you know, you learned a lot about how to network and communicate and strategize with people around you, I think 100 Minds helps young and upcoming entrepreneurs to figure that out as well. And, you know, how do you put on an event, or how do you organize things? Did you see anything cool when you were there, or any?
How I thought it was a great program as well, is that like when you're in college, to actually have somebody who's 2 years or 3 years ahead of you, just to kind of give you that really close guidance, so that they're not someone who's like a mentor who's like 20 years ahead of their career, they've just done it. So that was I think what I enjoyed giving back, and I think what a lot of the mentors actually gave back to the program. But yeah, there was like a few really, I think one guy or girl did a the Cube, like it ran a massive event that was based
the
around
same it. As that TV show, yeah, with the, around nice. That.
And there was kind of the white collar boxing kind of typical stuff, but there were some initiatives that raised like tens of thousands, like one student who was involved in it, and like, yeah, just really, really great initiatives. Yeah.
And it really helps you to kind of put yourself or when you're applying to those jobs at different companies, to kind of say, you know, this is something that's on my CV at that very early stage to get into different positions. So it's a cool initiative. And also, yeah, to go, I guess, one step back then, launching uni tuition within college, that was pretty cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was fine. That was something I was like, it was always in the background of like, I was a tutor myself. We actually didn't, when I initially set it up, it was called Trinity Tuition. It was just based in Trinity College, and it was just really myself running it. And then afterwards, when I started working full time, it kind of like just was like kind of fizzling away. It wasn't really doing much. And then my co-founder with Uni Tuition, Orla McCallion, she was doing a part-time master's, and she was like, if this is working in Trinity, like in a small scale, like what's to stop it working in all of the other colleges in Ireland and potentially abroad? Nice. And like realistically, it was her that was the one who said, yeah, let's turn this into something. I kind of was like, all right, if you want to do this, like I'll give you half of what I'm currently doing, and like we can set it up as a bigger company then, and actually like bring it to, we changed the name then to Uni Tuition. But yeah, it was her, like she brought it, like we developed a kind of a more automated website initially with like an offshore agency, and then we applied to, yeah, we got onto, I think we applied to Dublin Beta initially with Gene Murphy and Gary Layden and David Bowles sauce at that, and we're like, you should apply to the end of your C program. And still I was kind of thinking, I was like, I was in Accenture at this time, I was like, oh, this would be something nice on the side, it'd be interesting to do, and it's nice that people like the idea. So we applied to the end of your C program, and then got onto it. And in my head, I was like, oh, Orla, you can go and run this now in the end of your C. And they were like, no, like you both have to actually join this program if we're going to invest 30K into the company. And as in, I then start thinking about what the achievement was I supposed to get onto the end of your C in the first place. It wasn't like, I just thought it was like a Well, I kind of thought it was more of an easy thing to do, and then I realized actually like hundreds of companies apply to this, and it's actually more of an achievement. Maybe we should give it a shot. So I basically tried to hand in my notice to Accenture to do it, and they gave me 9 months off to do it instead. So,
wow, nice.
That was the first break, and myself and Orla then we ended up, I suppose, subsequently working on it for a much longer period than 9 months. But it was a great start, and for us it was our first, I suppose, official entrepreneur endeavor, and it kind of led me to then realize that this is actually not easier than I thought it was, but it's a lot easier to do different stuff that you don't have to be involved in sure. kind of the corporate world, or you don't have to be like, there's not one set route to having a day job.
That's and because of that ambiguity, it can be quite difficult to navigate as well, and to figure out what's the best for the product and so on. But it's amazing. Like, how did you and Orla come to meet? Were you friends within college first, or?
Yeah, so we actually competed in athletics when we were 14 or 15.
Wow.
We knew each other. We both ran for a Dublin athletics club, Clonliffe Harriers, and we knew each other when we were 14 or 15. Then we both kind of stopped doing athletics around 16, 17, and we then randomly bumped into each other again in college, like literally physically bumped into each other again.
Nice.
Probably I was in second year and Orla was in first year. We just became mates again, like, as in, just we had, like, we were both from different parts of Dublin, so we never actually just bumped into each other. It was before the time of, like, you were connected to everyone you knew, so I think like I don't think we were even Facebook friends or anything like that beforehand. Yeah. So then we just became like good mates, and we went on the same J1 together and worked in the same company over in the States together, and then when it just came about that it was like good timing, and that I kind of had the idea, but Orla had the, I suppose, time and then the ambition to actually turn it into something and work together to make a company out of it.
That's really amazing. I mean, I think, I don't know about you, and it'd be great to get your opinion, but I think so many people spend so much time figuring out, you know, who is the co-founder or who is the person that I should go and do this with, that they tend to put the brakes on the idea for a period of time, rather than, you know, if you can find somebody that's happy enough to go and launch something together with, you know, maybe you should just give it a shot and see where it goes.
Yeah, like, if I look now, like, I probably wasn't the ideal co-founder for Orla, and Orla wouldn't have been the ideal co-founder for me, in terms of we both had a very similar skill set.
Sure.
So, like, we both were, like, business strategy kind of type people, that when we actually had to hire in tech, and then we had a developer, and then obviously MiniCorp, then you guys built the kind of the platform for us, with us as well. But we spent an awful lot of money because we didn't have a tech person, and we had to hire in a developer for our first hire, to actually get stuff up and running and to have somebody working on the platform for us daily. I suppose we had the comfort of knowing what each other were like, and we were happy to set up the business. But again, if we were to strategically think it out a bit more, we probably wouldn't have picked each other as co-founders.
It makes a lot of sense, and it makes me ask the question to myself of what would that, you know, amazing co-founder team look like for a digital product. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people gravitate towards, you know, you have your business/business development person, CEO/business development person, maybe with a lot of domain knowledge in the sector that they're in. So within the university sector or whatever that product might be in, and then the other one to be the technical arm of that team. And you know, they may not be able to accomplish everything from a technical capacity. You know, both people may not be able to accomplish everything for their requirements, but it's enough to allow them to get off the ground and to kind of work as many hours as they need to in order to get that product to the initial stage, and then, you know, hire in more people underneath that to support it.
Yeah, we run a program now in Accenture called the Leaders of Tomorrow. So it's a startup entrepreneurship program, where initially for the first 10 years of that program, it's been going now 11 years, but for the first 10 years, we let early stage companies who were either in college or had graduated in the last year or two apply to the program. And over the years, it went from like kind of very small companies who had nothing applying to amazing companies who already had like hundreds of thousands in revenue, but were still happened to be in college, and then they were winning the program outright. So like we had guys like Dara and Shane from Groupies. They're based down the NDRC as well, good friends of ours. Like they would have won the program a few years ago. Then last year's winner was Izzy Wheels, Alva from Izzy Wheels. So like the program kind of shifted this year then to, instead of what we were realizing is, yeah, amazing companies were coming through, but there was also a lot of companies who were, I suppose, not, they didn't have the right team set up. So they were getting to the final stages, like the final, say, eight people in our competition, and we would have had 200, 300 applicants. But the actual team makeup, they mightn't have the right team makeup. So the product wasn't really going anywhere. So we decided to shift the program a bit to basically make it a program where people applied as individuals.
Sure.
And throughout a like summer program from around May to September, we'd actually shape them into teams so that they'd have the idea. It'd be almost like a really long startup weekend.
Yeah,
so that we then put them through their paces with different workshop days. But by the start of the actual summer program, we would have six or seven teams that are formed well. So they'd have a business person with domain knowledge. They'd have a technology person. They'd have someone from analytics, someone from marketing. And these teams now are working quite well, and that we're bringing them through the paces. And even if like these actual startups don't turn into fully fledged companies, I think that what they've learned over that summer program will definitely help them in their next business initiative or
hugely
endeavor.
I mean, I've always seen it as there's three elements to any startup or any business, especially successful ones. It's the team. So who is the founding team and what are their capabilities? The product itself. So what's the potentiality of the product and how will it become successful within the space that they want it to be? And number three, the resources or the capabilities that are on the table, be it from, you know, skills, strengths, to money, to, you know, all the other capabilities that it might need to acquire to launch different applications or different products. And I think when you look at that program, you know, you come to it with, let's say, an idea at the very beginning, and then you get paired with different people that will, you know, help you to have good strengths as a team. But they can pivot depending on the resources then to different areas, or when they go to launch another idea, they've seen how well they work with these different pairings that it could be really huge in the future. It's really clever.
Yeah, I think, I suppose that probably leads on to the next business that I started looking at. It was like is Upstarter. So like we were really struggling to find development talent and tech talent in uni tuition. And
yeah,
I was like, oh, look, we have to either advertise online and just pay really expensive job posting fees, or like just leverage our own network, which can be quite difficult as well. So we were like, oh, why don't we try set up a tech fair for startup companies to hire tech talent in. And initially, like, yeah, uni tuition had a stand at that, and we were hiring developers at it and trying to hire somebody at the event. And a lot of our other companies were early stage startups trying to do the same. And that would have been where, I suppose, that business idea came from as well, just the actual need for something ourselves.
Yeah. And were you... So there's quite a huge leap there, isn't it? Like, you're sitting back in your chair and you're kind of going, you know, it would be really difficult, or it seems to be really difficult, to get engineering talent or development talent. How will I solve that problem? Maybe we should do an event or some sort of a fair. To, you know, the turnout that's now coming to Upstarter and the amount of companies that are there, it's huge. It's like one of the biggest events here in Dublin. How did you, first of all, get your first event and get to, you know, to that point where so many people were hearing about it and going to it, and companies were starting to come on board? There's been a lot of learnings in there.
Yeah, so we ran it really small and lean for the first event. Accenture came on and sponsored it, so that was like, I had that nice link in there. Yeah. They came on, so that kind of covered that side of it. So then we actually just opened it up as, like, I think companies paid a small deposit just so I knew that they turned up to the event. So like, we had like some amazing like startups that like would be considered, like, I think we had like Bezimply were at it, Newswhip were at it. Like, there was just really cool tech startups that are quite big now, and they just turned up, and we had it in a bar. There was like 300 people, free tab, and like people were coming along and just like chatting to the other companies. And we ran that probably three times over from, say, I think it was started in February, so February, April, June. And by the June event, we had a waiting list of 700 people to attend the event.
Oh my God.
So like, we were like, yes, if this is getting to this stage now, we should probably just try to expand it.
There's a clear market need.
Yeah. So then I hired a guy to kind of more concentrate on the sales side of things. And we ended up running it in a larger venue for about, I think there was about 900 people came to the first big event. It was in the Paris Court Center. Other bigger companies start getting involved in it. So like, we had like Jobio, who are now one of our main partners for the event, Groupon, Zendesk, Accenture had a big presence at that event as well. So just start getting kind of start moving towards like the bigger tech companies, but we still always had like an element of like a pretty cheap startup fair for the startups to attend as well.
Sure.
So because we wanted, I suppose, the people who were coming to this event to want to work in startups, but also see that there's an alternative. And by having the bigger names at it as well, it also attracted, I suppose, more people, and also other people who might not want to work necessarily in a startup as their main route, but then they might get talking to a cool startup completely accidentally, and then end up applying for a job there instead.
I think it's a huge moment, I think. And when we ever had interns in MiniCorp, I think it's really good, and I think it's really healthy for engineers or designers to work in a very small product or small team and to have a big impact on a small product. But I think it's also their own due diligence for themselves to kind of see what it's like to work on the other side, to work on, you know, with a large company and have a small impact, but in a large company, because it's only at that point that you see both sides of the sword and you kind of say, I prefer it on the left, I prefer it on the right. And, you know, having Upstarter enable that for, you know, engineers to just kind of look around and see what's available is huge. It's huge on what their career could be, you know?
Yeah. Like the event has gone, from strand to strand. It's like the attendees have kind of like plateaued at the venue size at this stage.
Yeah. How many is the last event?
The last event, we got hit with the worst weather Dublin has ever seen in March. It was like, we had about 1200, which was the first one that actually was a dip from attendees. Like we had about 1500 across the previous two events, but then the weather was absolutely horrific and we had about 1200 on that night.
Have you seen any trends with the engineers? So you know the way like all the startups are saying, you know, the big companies are swallowing up all of the engineers, is that true?
So it really depends on what you class as a big company now. So I would say our most successful hirer at Upstarter is Intercom. So Intercom hire the most people at every event, and they're a great sponsor because when they do it really well, they come to the event with the right people, and they come to the event with they have a big stand, they do go all out for that event. But it's great to see like when we are at the next event that they come to, and they'll introduce me to, oh, this is John, we hired John from the last event, and John's now at this event talking to people. And like companies like that do it well, and I suppose like people would consider Intercom in startup world, that's a really, really big company. But in compared to large corporates like the Big Four or like Amazon or Facebook, like they're relatively small.
Yeah.
So, but I think they're doing it right, and like engineers are gravitating towards companies like that now, where they get in on the ground, they get a lot of, I suppose, autonomy on the product that they're working on, and they're not working really behind the scenes as much.
And
I think that is a big trend I'm noticing. Like we get obviously our fair share of like complaints of I didn't hire enough people at this event, or we've had people, I didn't hire my CTO at this event, but I'm like, well, like, you got to go for it. You got to talk to enough people. You got to have the stands manned. You got to go out and, like, here's an example of someone doing it really well. And, like, if they can hire six people at an event, I'm pretty sure you can hire two or three as well.
Exactly. And I think, you know, there's an overlap there of, you know, you've created this melting pot of having all of these wonderful people in a room together, and, you know, you're trying to get them to have conversations and introduce themselves. But it's amazing the different types of people that are there, and you're completely right that they have to just go for it. And I think, like, I've noticed a lot in very young startups that they're not able to really sell their company well, like, to a potential hire. They should live and breathe the company, and they should, you know, be talking about the vision and where the company is going and why, and, you know, why they might be the right person to come and work at that company, and to really give them the pitch of, like, this is where we are right now and this is where we're going to be, rather than, hey, we're looking for a Rails dev. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and, like, again, back to Intercom, like, they sell that content and that vision. Like, they, a lot of their blog posts are about what it's like to work in Intercom. Yeah. And, like, where they're going, what their founders see as their vision. And, like, we're not selling. We're going to keep building this until it's, like, a 200, like way bigger than what the size is currently. But, yeah, no, I think it's what we find as well, companies who are attending it now are actually doing it a lot more for their own employees. So they're like, oh, we're currently locked up in a building out in Leopardstown, and doing an event like this actually gets our employees really engaged. So, like, we're actually getting that side of it as well, yeah. Which is kind of, like, for me working in Accenture, I was like, oh, we go to so many events and we do so many things like this, and I never thought that would be an actual selling point.
Yeah.
But it's coming as now as a thing that they're like, oh, we love going to Upstart, or our employees love going to that. It's a great night out. I'm like,
class. Okay.
It's kind of an offshoot advantage of, and it makes it easier for me, I suppose, to sell it. But
Yeah, but I think there's unreal power in that, though. Like, I remember MiniCorp had a stand at it in Four Dame Lane at one point, and we got so much traction from that event. It was amazing. Like, people coming, what do you do? Why do you do it?
We've realized that the big event is great for branding, and, like, you get 1,500 people, and you might get through 300 or 400 of them each if you have, like, enough people on your stand. But a lot of the time you actually miss out on people who are in the room.
Totally.
So we've actually started running, like, two kind of offshoot events, so that you attend the big event and then you get to attend the smaller events for free. So we have, like, a women in tech event where it's just female applicants who,
sure,
like, if in companies that are trying to get that gender balance right. And then we have a superstar series, which is actually we screen all the applicants. So instead of it just being everybody allowed to attend, we look at who are our sponsors and our companies who are attending are looking to hire. And then we filter that down based on the hire. So we had, the last event was in June, again, hit by weather, but the opposite side of it, it was the sunniest day of the year. It was, like, so hot. So we got, it was in Four Dame Lane again, though, and we had 700 applicants, and we screened that down to 150 that came in on the night. And the companies were actually more responsive to that event than they were to the bigger event, because instead of feeling like they missed out on a lot of people in the room, they actually got to talk to the entire room.
Yes.
So, like, the smaller events are actually proven to be kind of a successful kind of niche that we've
launched. It's like that intimate gig with whoever the different companies are.
Yeah.
It's big. Do you think... So, one thing that I've always noticed about product, and especially tech products, is that when the product is being built, the feeling that the technology should automate a lot of the processes is almost inherent at the beginning. So whatever we're building, can we get technology to solve this problem and that problem? And that's great and it makes a ton of sense to me. But if you take a step back from that, what it also removes you from is getting to intimately know the different customers or what the problems are in order to figure out, is this really the right solution or not? And something that really sticks out in my head is that whole Joe Gabia thing in Airbnb, when he got accepted into Y Combinator, and I can't remember who turned around to him, but basically said, you know, you must be getting some traction in order for you to be here. How many customers do you have? Where are they? What's going on? And Joe was basically, we have very few customers, but they're all based in New York, which is really strange for us. And the guy turned around and said, why are you in San Francisco? Why are you in Y Combinator? Why are you here, basically? Why are you not in New York? And he said, well, that's not going to be scalable for me. Like, I don't want to just have customers, those customers in New York. I want it to grow like exponentially and for all of that to happen. He said, but now is the time when you get to meet your customers. You get to figure out the people who will use the product and, you know, really have real conversations with them. And I look at all of these, you know, hiring applications and all of the different technology that's being developed around that space. And then I look at just the conversation that we're having right now. And it feels like that real physicality, the getting to meet the different potential candidates that are out there, or even just for good engineers to talk to other good engineers and just to have great conversations and to see where that goes. And then you talk about this Superstars event. It's like applying just a little sprinkle of technology at some point of going, okay, what is the demographic or what is the profiling of the different companies that are going to be at the Superstar event, and what are the potential candidates, and how can we, you know, match them correctly together?
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose like the we have a partner in Jobbio, so they're all online, and they saw with us that we brought the physical element to the event, so that like we, all of our companies now, when they sign up to Upstarter, they get a profile on Jobbio that then is kind of like uploaded into an API onto our website.
Nice, okay.
So that there's like an Upstarter channel, and so like by combining the two of them together, I think you get the best of both worlds. But on the knowing your customer thing, as in, I think like that's more relevant to like when we were starting uni tuition, that like when we first had our first like 20, 30 users and our first 10, 15 tutors, we knew every tutor. We knew exactly what their nice skill set was. Yeah. We knew exactly like who we could send to them. And as it grew to 1,500 tutors and 10,000 people using it, we lost that. And like by losing that, if you don't have the right automation processes set up, I suppose it falls over, and there's too much, I suppose, manual intervention, and that's a problem that kind of led to the ultimate like not being able to scale uni tuition to a size that made sense. Like it was like closing uni tuition was such a it was bittersweet in that like we actually were closing a company that was making money, but it wasn't making enough to make it a business. And someone recently said to me, like, they were like, oh yeah, having a market and knowing that your product is relevant to a market isn't what makes a company. Your market has to be big enough to make the company. And like when we shut down uni tuition, we got so many emails being like, I can't believe you're shutting this down. I use this all the time. And the tutors being like, this is what's like putting me through college. Like, I'm using this as my source of income. But it was just that there was 20 or 30 of those emails. It wasn't that there was 3,000 of those emails that we had. It was just never going to be big enough to justify it as a company that would support a team of what we had. But again, it was bittersweet in that you got to realize that. And like,
it's cool to get that though.
It's good to notice it. And that's why like if I was to set up another thing like at the same time as Upstarter or like I'd in Ireland, I think focusing on B2B is just, it's not saying it's a lot easier, but it just makes more sense because you're not, like, Ireland is a niche in itself. So if you're focusing on the Irish market, you really need to do something that the Irish market is known for. And we have all these tech companies, or we have all these users. So that's why Upstarter works, because my target audience and my customer is tech companies, and there's hundreds of them everywhere. Whilst when you're going B2C, you have a pretty small user base starting off with, and then obviously you're only going to get a very small percentage of that user base in the start. So yeah, just like the B2C market, I think, just works so much better. And like, I think I'm not the first person to make this realization, as in the successful companies coming out of Ireland and the really successful ones, I'd be hard pushed to actually name a few that use Ireland as their main market that are B2C.
Yeah. I can't even count on one hand the amount of successful B2C plays that I've seen. Like, there's, you know, Ray Nolan, Hostel World. I don't know, like, there's so few.
And like very quickly they would have had a UK and then a European or a US focus very, very quickly. That's what we tried to do as well, but the market just didn't exist in the same form in the UK.
It's cool the way that you figured it out though, because I've seen or witnessed so many times when people don't get to that point. Like we have this workshop phase within MiniCorp, and the whole point of it is to say, you know, what are we building and why are we building it? But also a big element of that is, what are the failure goals that we're going to set? So if we don't get to like 5K in recurring revenue by month six, we're going to close it. Or if we don't get to like 50,000 users by the end of the year, we'll close it. And that, you know, it gives them something to kind of say, you know, there is success in this product. There is like a goal that we want to hit. Just getting recurring revenue in the door is not it. There's other metrics that we really need to focus on.
Yeah. And like ours was, we got to a point, I suppose, within the first, I'd say, 18 months, where the recurring revenue was actually coming all from our second product that we launched only 2 months ago. So if we had spent, I suppose, a longer period of time focusing on that product when we had funding in the door and we had kind of that, I suppose, comfort money, we probably would have been in a lot better shape, but we didn't know that was going to be the case. But yeah, the recurring revenue isn't the be end and end all. Like, we, as a B2C company, we wouldn't have, like, we were making revenue from day one, but the company wouldn't have been a company if we weren't making money from day one. It's a bit different than...
It's difficult.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a ton more that I actually wanted to talk about, but I think we need to wrap it up today. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a really deadly conversation. I would ask just to... If people on Twitter or on social media wanted to contact you, how would they get in touch?
Yeah, you can get me on Twitter as well, like, if you want to tag me in that.
I'll stick you in all the description things.
Twitter is an easy one for everyone to reach out to me on.
And yeah, no, a huge thank you for coming on, and hopefully we'll have you on as a guest again soon.
Yeah, cool. Well, cheers for having me. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks. Cheers, John.
Yep. Yeah.